Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to inspiring women. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Helen Croydon. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Nikki.
So, Helen Croydon is an author, a journalist, a publicist, a speaker, and a triathlon athlete.
Yeah.
Now, Helen, you originally had a career working in national newsrooms, and you switched your focus to help others raise their profile. You've said it's hard to make money in media. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, hard to make money in media. Gosh, where do I start on that topic? It's my favourite topic to talk about at the moment. I always wanted to be a journalist and an author from a very young age, and I worked very hard to achieve that dream. So I think it's bittersweet in a way that I achieved my dream in that I've got three books published. As a freelance journalist, I managed to write in every single UK national newspaper, I think, and I worked in national newsrooms, mostly at ITN. In terms of, I've achieved my goal. I did it. It's really hard to get a book deal. I got three. But you know what? And none of that made me any money. And that's why I think it's a bittersweet. It's that classic dilemma of the creative industries, isn't it? Yeah. So that, you know, you strive to do something you love, and there are so many talented people in the creative industries, so many talented writers, singers, actors, and only a very, very few actually managed to make money from it. So very recently, I switched my focus. Instead of getting myself in the media through journalism and books, I thought, I'm going to make other people get in the media because there's definitely a market for that. And I think that change came because I started to get so many questions from friends of friends and colleagues, you know, saying things like, oh, how can I get my business in the Times? Or I've got a new jewellery business. How can I get for it? And I think I just got so sick of people asking me all these things. I thought, right, I'm going to monetize this.
Are you going to make money from this? Exactly.
Now,
traditional media, as you say, it's very hard. But what about the influencers? Because bloggers have their own communities, loyal followers and advertisers, and seem to make an awful lot of money now. Isn't that the case?
Some do, but I think it's a very few that do it well. But it's interesting because they have changed the model of media. And now, you see, the way to make money, I think, from publicity is through driving a business. Whereas it might have been that once you might get paid for, say, writing an article, or you might get paid for doing a TV appearance in itself. So a journalist or a broadcaster could make money just simply by using their writing skills or using their broadcasting skills. Now, you see, because so many people want to be on TV or they want to get a byline in a newspaper, the editors and the producers, they've all cottoned on. So they're not paying them anymore. They're saying, well, no, you can write for us, but hey, we're not going to pay you because so many people want to do it. There is that. So these bloggers and influencers, they're doing things for free, but the benefit for them is in raising their profile. So unless you have a business to promote or a service to promote, you can't monetize writing itself. So in a way, you think there's another stage being added to the chain of media, in that it used to be write an article, get paid. Now it's write an article, don't get paid, but drive traffic to your website, therefore drive business, therefore get paid. So it's become a lot more complex.
And quite exciting as well. And the opportunities for women are immense, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Because I think there is this climate now of working for yourself, inventing yourself, becoming your own personal brand. So there are lots of women out there who don't want to work full time because they've got children or whatever. And this new model of working and monetizing yourself purely through profile and publicity has become viable for many people that don't want that full-time working structure, and many of those happen to be women.
Exactly. Now, who do you help then? You've got thought leaders, philanthropists, politicians and celebrities. Who have you got? Any Brexiters?
Well, any Brexiters. So I have to be quite discreet about my client.
Fair enough. Only tell us the ones.
So what I do, just to clarify, it's not really traditional PR, it's more the personal PR, so raising the profile of the person. And the reason that has value is all the reasons I just said before, because if you can raise your personal profile, it tends to drive business to your actual business. And it is much easier to PR a person than it is to PR a business. Yes. And that's what I learned through being an author myself and trying to PR myself as an author. Yes. And trying to PR myself as a journalist. I know where all those opportunities are.
Now, we want to talk about your books. I know you've talked about that. You've written three books, of which one is a bestseller and one was shortlisted for the William Hill Book Award. I mean, that's amazing. How is life as an author? Which one was the bestseller? And how did we do it?
Well, life as an author is great, but it is poor. And that's why I moved away from being an author. But because I think I always said to myself, I am an author and journalist. So for 9 years, I was a freelance author and journalist. And for another 5 years, I worked full-time in a newsroom. So for 15 years, I've been a journalist. I think for at least 7 of those years, I feel like I've been flogging a dead horse in that I always thought, oh, the next book might make money. Or, oh, this year I might get a column or something. But it's always this sense of you are always in this middle level when it comes to journalism and books. You scrape a living and get by, but you never really make any more money than that. The thing about writing a book is that it just brings you a lot of prestige and respect, and it is a fantastic feeling to see that book come through the door 3 weeks before publication when you get your review copy and you see your name on it. And that is fantastic. And that is worth the 3 years slogging that it took to write each one of my book. So I've written three books, and each one took about 3 years, I'd say, from the nascent idea stage to actually get going to print. Now, that doesn't mean that I was writing it every single day for 3 years. I think a book takes at least a year just to gestate, you know, the idea. So I was doing lots of other things in the background, but writing notes, reading other books in that genre, and just trying to establish what is it exactly that I'm trying to write here. So my first book was a dating memoir.
Oh, yes, The Sugar Daddy Diaries. I've got that here. In 2011, The Sugar Daddy Diaries, you were propelled into a world of Prada shopping trips, fine dining, first-class travel, and fascinating, powerful men. Now, was this about you?
Yes,
it was. The truth is out. I think it always has to be, doesn't it? You've got to write about what you know.
Exactly.
How much older were these sugar daddies?
How old were my sugar daddies? Well, everyone...
What are we talking about here?
Well, it's all relative to my age at the time. So I was 28 when I... indulge in those adventures of which I wrote about. The book came out when I was 31, but the time that I was writing about was when I was 28. And I'd always had a thing for older men. So when I say older men, I think when I think older men now, people in my age, and I'm in my 40s, people say, oh, you mean a 60-year-old man. But when I was 28, an older man meant 40. Yeah. So I think I'd always liked that.
No, they're not 80.
No, I've yet to. Although, who knows, when I'm 60, I might go for 8-year-olds. I don't know.
Now,
but
in 2014, there was Screw the Fairy Tale, The Modern Girl's Guide to Sex and Love, where you mentioned that marriage and kids aren't on your radar. Everyone tells you that you'll become one of those ladies with cats. I mean, have you got a cat? Was that because of the life experience that was surrounding you that people were getting married? That, were you angry? And that was expressing how you really felt as well?
I definitely wasn't angry. I just never really wanted this ideal that was being pushed at me all the time, that's pushed at a lot of women, that, you know, you need to find a partner who answers your every need and you need to live together and share a bed. I mean, imagine that. You don't get a decent night's sleep when you share a bed. And you've got to go to every social outing together. And I just never wanted that. And I've never wanted children either. And I've always been quite vocal about that. It's not that I don't like children, I just don't want the lifestyle. So this very thought that I need to fit into this box that everyone seems to want really made me quite passionate and quite vocal about kind of rejecting that. And I think I got frustrated by everyone not believing me. So I was a modern independent woman in my late 20s and early 30s, just on the dating scene. And it was when all the internet dating was in its height. It was before the days of Tinder. It was all like new and exciting. And for me, it was such like an exciting journey and a journey of self-discovery, learning about myself and about other people. I was in a bit of a party stage in life. And I genuinely did not want any more than that. But everyone I came across, friends or friends' boyfriends, couldn't understand that. And they'd always say, no, but you want to settle down really, right? Oh, you change your mind in 5 years. So I think what propelled me to write that book was just pure frustration that people didn't get what I was trying to say, or they didn't. I find it quite patronizing because it was as though they weren't taking my views seriously.
Yes.
So I wrote that book to try to depict the modern landscape of relationships. So I wanted to find couples in all different models of relationships, such as an open marriage, married couples that live apart, even to a polyamorous commune, and interviewed 15 people in one relationship. So lots of weird and wonderful stuff that I wanted to portray in this book, just to kind of say, well, it's not all about the fairy tale, hence the title of the book, Screw the Fairy Tale.
Yeah, very apt, and a lot of people can relate to that, you know. Obviously, Bridget Jones in her movies, you know, surrounded by couples and feels frustrated like that. But you like to ponder about love, instinctively sort of teaching other people about love.
Yeah, so when I was a journalist, the topic that I specialised in was dating, relationships, modern families, and all the sociological and psychological implications of all that. So because I was fascinated in that area at the time in my life when I decided to become a freelance journalist. It wasn't that I woke up one day and said, right, I want to be a thought leader in the field of relationships. It just happened to be that as a writer, you write about what fuels you at the time and you write about what is most interesting to you. So that's why I ended up writing a dating memoir as my first book. Sometimes I kind of wish maybe it would have been better if I wrote a book about saving orphans or something like that. It might have made for a slightly cleaner Google search history, but hey, I didn't.
Brilliant. And you learn so much about yourself as well, don't you? It's just fabulous. Now, in 2018, there was the athlete book that emerged out of The City Girl, ditched your suits for Lycra, and became a Team GB athlete. I mean, did you just wake up one day and just think, that's it, I've had enough of it, kick these heels off, trainers on, I'm off. How did that happen?
It was a little bit like that. It wasn't one day, though. So that book, it's called This Girl Ran, and that is about, ditching the party girl lifestyle and discovering a more wholesome side of life and discovering the outdoors and just discovering how tough I was. Discovering how we are all a lot tougher than we think we are. So how that came about, I did just wake up one day and think, wow, is this all there is to life, going out, going to cocktail bars, chatting with girlfriends over wine, and then waking up the next day and feeling not quite productive because you've drank a bit too much. I started to just not want to drink as much. Not that I was drinking loads. I think I was just like any other young professional living in a city, and that my whole social life revolved around drinking. So I thought, right, okay, I'm going to cut down on drinking. But then when you cut down on drinking, no matter what anyone says, it is boring going out. And all these people say, I don't want to drink, but have a good time. They're like, whatever, you do. It's boring, right? So I just thought, I need something in my social life that doesn't involve drinking, that I can still have that banter with people that I crave, that I can still have that social satisfaction. So I just joined a running club. And it was just like, I think I Googled fitness clubs, and I wasn't really a runner. I mean, I was a recreational runner. I went jogging along the river, and I've always been a gym kind of person, but I wasn't an outdoorsy, tough type. So suddenly I was just propelled into this world of what I thought were quite tough people. They weren't, they're not tough, they're lovely people from all walks of life that happened to go to a London running club. But in my eyes, they were like, oh my God, they wear hoodies in the bar, and they go to cross-country races in the weekend, and they wear like waterproofs and get covered in mud. And this is just from my kind of glamorous city life. This is a world apart. But I also really just liked that contrast to my life. And I started going to races at weekends, which they're only short cross-country races, like 5 miles or something. So it's hardly like I was doing a marathon. But just the very idea of going to a cold, wet, windy, muddy field on a Saturday was so out of my comfort zone that I kind of wanted to do more because I felt it was pushing me, it was pushing my boundaries. So over time, over about a period of 2 or 3 years, I just started doing more and more challenges. I started road cycling. And again, that means, you know, you're battling things like extreme weather, getting a puncture when you're in the middle of nowhere and you absolutely have to fix it. Otherwise, well, otherwise you're screwed because there's no Ubers out 60 miles out of London. And even if there were Ubers, they won't take your bike in the boot. So just things like that, you know, small things. It was hardly like I was trekking up mountains, but they were all just little things that were pushing me out of my comfort zone. And I wanted to do more and more. And then I started open water swimming, which for me, someone who feels the cold, was a real challenge. And the first time I did it, I went blue. I literally went blue. And I had to be dressed by my friends because I couldn't move my hands. So I just physically couldn't dress myself. And then over time, then I started doing triathlon. I just got more and more into it. And then eventually I did a qualification race for a world championship event. And I thought, I haven't got a hope in hell of qualifying. Why am I even doing this? I got up at 4 a.m. to do this race. And to my absolute amazement, I qualified. So the triathlon is the one sport where you can qualify in your age group. So I wasn't elite level, it was still very amateur level, but because it's classified in 5 years. But it was Team GB, yeah. It's an age group, Team GB. So it's not the Team GB, which is affiliated with the Olympics.
It's still Team GB.
So, yeah. So
that's amazing. So literally from naught to Team GB, that's awesome.
The girl that didn't want to run through a puddle in case it ruined my pedicure, to swimming in Lake Michigan, which was where the world championships were held. You know, it is amazing going from this quite precious city girl to being a hardened triathlete who would go training in any weather. Just is proof that I think all of us can get out of our comfort zones and can do things that we don't think we can, and also we can break out of the stereotypes that we have of ourselves. You know, we think we are a certain way, and actually we can reinvent ourselves.
We like, good for you. Gosh, I'm not sure if I'm quite in that league, but that's amazing. Now, I know that we obviously met socially, and I know there may be a book in the offing. I don't know, there might be another book that you've met your match, because obviously I've met your boyfriend as well. But I remember you saying he only accompanies you for 3 hours cycling instead of the 6 that you'd like to do. Do you consider that a bit of a lightweight, do you? But common interests obviously help, you know.
Well, he gets bored on cycle rides. So I like, if I go running or cycling, I like to max it out, you know. I just love that feeling of complete exertion. I love that feeling that I pushed my body. And it's great that I've met a man who is also outdoorsy and does all these things with me, because it just means we have so much more to do than simply sit in bars or go to restaurants, which is what I've done with all my other previous relationships. So that's brilliant. And the reason he doesn't come out for 5 or 6 hours like I do, and he just joins me for 3, is not because he's a lightweight, but he's just busy. He's got 3 daughters, and on weekends he feels like he needs to go and spend a bit of time with them. And he's got animals, like he lives in the countryside, and he needs to go and service them. So that it's simply that. I mean, he's not, he's actually tougher than I am, because he comes from a military background and he's done all this tough stuff in the military. So I think, whereas I now push myself a lot in sport, because when I was younger, I didn't. So for me, I think I've still got that semblance of, I want to prove that I can do it. Yes. And maybe that's why I will still go out cycling in a rainstorm, because I'll feel like I'm a bit of a dropout if I don't. Whereas he's already done all that when he was younger.
Yeah, exactly. How do we turn our ideas into novels, or even know where to start? I know you've given some talks on this. Do we literally write about what we know or what we feel? Do you plan the outline, the chapters, the end first? Has everyone got a book in them? What do we do? Where are the sort of the principles, without giving away your usual speaking engagements?
Everyone does have a book in them, and this is what I teach when I've done writing courses, is that it's about how you, the story story of your life in a way that relates to other people. And so much of life is attached to that skill. So as a journalist, I've been trained, it's become endemic in me, to look for the story in something. You know, you have to leap through reams of really crap press releases, and somewhere in there might be buried a story. That's what journalists do. Or you interview someone for ages, and it's only till you get to, like, you know, 45 minutes in, you're like, oh yeah, there's the story. And this is what journalists are trained to do. So being a writer is a similar skill. Or it's the same, I give media training as well, and that's exactly the same skill. It's all about what is the story. So as a memoir writer, I have used that skill, and that's what I try and impart to other people when they come to me for writing advice. It's about finding the aspects of your experience that relates to other people. So who would have thought that there'd be a book in the fact that I just joined a running club and then took up marathons and triathlons and went to some race in Chicago? On the face of it, it's not a very interesting story, is it? But actually, the reason why I managed to make it into a book, and the reason why I got that book commissioned by a publisher, is because I put all the other socially relevant topics into that, such as the fact that many women are put off sport because they feel like they need to pertain to this glamorous image. The fact that many of us believe that we can't do things and we never push ourselves out of our comfort zone. The fact that all our social culture is embedded in drinking, and that's why many of us don't go out into the outdoor. You know, all things like that, socially relevant. And that is the key, I think, in putting it into a book or a memoir. It's not your personal story in itself. It's your personal story and how it can be relayed to the masses. Yes. So how do you start then writing a story? You've got to think about, you know, what do other people find interesting in this story?
Interesting. And I think that really helps. It's putting flesh on the bones of something and making it real and making it human.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do a memoir writing course at a college, and I bring up lots of examples of books that on the surface of it don't seem like interesting stories. So, you know, recently I've noticed that there's loads of doctor memoirs. There's quite a lot of them around, you know, doctors that have kind of spilled the beans of what it's like to work inside the NHS. Again, you wouldn't think that was interesting. But why is it interesting? It's because that's the topical debate right now. The state of the NHS, the obesity crisis, the fact that none of us are looking after our health, all those things. And it's all those themes that are tied up in that story. And that's what makes it into a story. So I can speak on behalf of, you know, creating a memoir. I'm not such an expert of how do you write a novel, because I haven't written any. But in a way, writing a memoir has lots of parallels to writing a novel, because you're not just writing your chronological story, because that would be boring and that would be indulgent and a little bit narcissistic. What you're doing is you're taking elements of your life and you are picking out interesting bits, and you're picking out the issues of the zeitgeist. You're picking out the bits that are relevant for cultural debate. Brilliant. So there was still an element of creative writing in memoir.
Yes, I think that'll help people an awful lot. And then you can evolve it into something that's really topical or in the press or really current, as you say, and then capitalise on that. And I think that'll help a lot of people who are trying to shape a book. And so you don't write the end first? You know, do you find the agent first? Do you self-publish?
Oh, gosh, that is a big question. The self-published versus the traditional publisher route is such a hot topic in the writing community right now. I went down the traditional publisher route, and I think when I got my first book published, it was 2011, and I think then just about the traditional publishing industry was probably still, you know, the most prestigious way to do it, and I think the self-publishing route was still kind of seen as, oh, that's a last resort option. In the space, so that was 2011. So in the space of, what are we now? So it's basically 2019. Hold on, what's my math?
8 years.
In the space of 8 years, I think that has changed. And now the self-publishing route is not as, can I say, frowned upon? I don't think it's ever frowned upon, but it's considered, not considered a cop-out anymore. And I know some very high-profile authors that have got several best-selling books under their name who've now gone, you know what, I'm ditching my publisher and I'm self-publishing. They can do that because they've already got a profile, but others, you know, that's paving the way for others to do it. And certainly, so that's the prestige value. I think the traditional publisher and the self-publishing route, they're catching up with each other. That's the prestige value. Then in terms of the money value, there's absolutely more money in self, because if you know how to market it, and that's the thing. And that goes back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast. The whole everything in media now is all down to marketing. It's how well you can push yourself. So these bloggers and influencers, they make it because they can push themselves. They know how to do search engine optimization. It's the same for authors now. If you can push your book on a search engine and on Amazon, you can make money from it. It's not about the writing skills anymore. It's about how you market it and how you get it in front of people.
Yep, and knowing that technology. Brilliant. Now, I think that'd be really helpful to a lot of people. Now, you've also been on TV. You've been on Sky and ITV as a thought leader yourself. Now, is sport your specialist subject, or is there another driving passion?
When I've been invited to go on TV, it's always been to discuss something topical that I've written about before. So it used to be that I got wheeled out whenever a celebrity had an affair, because I used to write about relationships. So, you know, some high profile celebrity has an affair, boom, relationships are in the news. Therefore, hey, let's get a so-called relationship expert to talk about it. And then Google journalists that write about relationships, and I would come up because that's what I was writing about at the time. More recently, because I've happened to write about getting into outdoor sport and toughening up and triathlon, now I seem to get asked to talk about women in sport and women ditching glamorous images and health and fitness and that kind of thing. So it's very much dictated by how you're branded. It's not like I ever go to TV and say, hey, I can talk about this. It's more like they
find
me according to what I've written about.
Yes, of course. So be an expert. So which strong women or men have inspired you?
You know what? No one in the public eye. You know, when everyone asks you these questions, who would you most like to have dinner with and all that? I never have an answer for it. And you know what? It's because I don't have a clue who anyone famous is. And I think this is because I have never watched TV and followed popular culture. And in a way, that's been an advantage. And maybe that's why I've had time to write books. But in another way, it's been my downfall in many ways, in that I'm absolutely clueless when the conversation turns to popular culture or pub quizzes or even in the newsroom. I mean, I can't believe I was a national news journalist. I didn't have a clue who like all these famous people were. So whenever someone high profile died and we had to do a quick obituary, I'd be like secretly Googling who they were, because I am terrible. So for that reason, I can't think of any, you know, household name type people that really influenced me, because I've never been drawn into that at all.
You're more of a curious journalist of self-discovery, by the way you've written. And well, that's okay. You're your own strong
influence. Then I've obviously been influenced by people in my immediate life. And I'd say my family have influenced me a lot. I mean, the fact that I'm quite entrepreneurial and I've always wanted to go it alone must be because both my parents were entrepreneurs. I had their own businesses. I remember them both saying, don't ever own your own business because it's so much work. And hey, what am I doing owning my own business?
It's really cool. Can we talk about your other passions then? How do you relax or spend any time off on a very long swim or cycle, by the sounds of it?
Yeah, I do. I think sport is my, is how I like to spend my free time. So a weekend, I never feel a weekend is complete unless I get either a long ride in or a long run in. I mean, that is what I want to do every weekend. I very rarely relax in the evening because I find it, I've always got like an overflow of all the work that I haven't done in the day. I'm always like finishing it off at night or I'm out with friends. I do like a kind of a good chin wag with a friend. So I suppose that would be my downtime. But you know what? The time when I'm most like relaxed and just not on it is the morning. I find it so hard to get started in the morning. I never really start work properly till like 10 or 11. And then I'm always mad with myself because I'm always on the back foot. And I think, why isn't that? But it's just, I don't know, I have this, I just can't get any urgency. So maybe I just think of it the other way around. You know, I don't sit down and watch TV at night, but I think I've just got to accept that the morning's the time when I love having a slow breakfast, listening to Radio 4. and I've got emails pouring in and messages coming in, and I just ignore them all a bit. Oh, I'm just watching the news right now.
Well, we're all different, and you know, that'll take some of the guilt away from all the people listening that, you know, women particularly have an awful lot to do in the day, and we can never get on top of everything. So, you know, you can have your downtime in the morning or at night or with TV or whatever people are into. It's none of it we need to feel guilty about, do we? So do you have a mantra for living your life, or a saying, you know, something that makes you inspired? Maybe some of the things you said earlier that, you know, that to get outside your comfort zone. You know.
I have a few. I think the one phrase that really resonates with me the most is "you only live once." Or this is not the dress rehearsal. Anything like that really gets to the heart of me, because it gives me the sense of, oh my God, we haven't got long. We've got to just do things. And I think that's what you've got to do in life. You've just got to get up and do things. And I've never been scared of failing. I have quite an experimental attitude to life. It's kind of, well, let's just try this then. If it fails, it fails. You know, let's just write a dating memoir and put my sex life all out there on Google, and let's just see what happens.
And be brave, I think, is coming through as one of your mantras.
Or just, rather than be brave, because I'm not that brave. I don't get nervous about things, but I just think you've got to live life, haven't you? I remember my dad always saying, you know, if ever I complained about something or ever he heard someone getting old, he'd say, well, it's better than the alternative, you know, and it's just being here and being alive. We don't know how long we've got, do we? So we've got to fill your life.
That is true, better than the alternative. I like that, yes. What's your next goal then, Helen?
My next goal is building this PR practice where I'm raising the profiles of individuals. So it's been quite a recent switch. And I'm really excited and passionate about just suddenly getting into business. So having been from, you know, media, writing books, being very creative, writing articles, I've suddenly gone, there is no money in that. I'm not going to flog a dead horse anymore. I'm going to completely change my skills, and I'm building this business, and I'm going to help use all my knowledge of the media and the publishing industry and help other people do it. I'm a bit sad to think that I'm not writing books anymore. I can no longer call myself a author and journalist, because I did like that title. Oh, I said, I'm always a journalist. I'm a journalist.
Of course. And I think it's more strings to your bow. And in fact, so many of the women that I interview, and actually it comes through that they've had multiple careers. They do multiple jobs. They have 3, 4, 5 different aspects to them. So I don't think people have to pigeon themselves as I'm an author, I'm a this, you know, I do all these things, you know, is something that's liberating and inspiring for a lot of the listeners to know that they can do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you can reinvent yourself as well. As, you know, these days,
exactly.
And there's so many people that have changed their career, had a sudden change in direction. It's interesting because there was a girl who worked, so for a while I worked at a PR agency, being a consultant for them. And there was a young girl who worked there. She was only 19, and I was managing her. It was like my first experience of managing. And it was so nice because she came up to me one day. She wanted a word. I thought she was going to talk about work or something. She just said, I just want your advice, because I'm only 19 and I don't know what, I don't really want to be in this job, and I don't know what I want to do. And it says she's coming to a manager and like telling me she doesn't want to be in a job, you know, so she must have felt comfortable enough to say that to me.
Of course. Everyone else, don't they?
Yeah, I said to her, like, you're 19. Can reinvent yourself.
And I say that to my teenagers as well, to say, you know, sometimes it's easier to know what you don't want to do than what you do want to do. But, you know, you gravitate towards what gives you a fire in your belly, what excites you, what you're interested in, and you'll meet people in that, and something will happen, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
What would be your final message to them to inspire and influence women and men, because about 40% of our listeners are men?
Go out there and live life. And no matter what you do, I think everyone's memory is short-lived. That's what I will say. So no matter what you do, no matter what mistake you make, no matter if you make a fool of yourself or to use that example that I used before, write a slightly racy dating memoir that gets put on Google, like, it gets forgotten. And no one can, and all the things that we worry about now, all the little niggles that we have in our life, in 5 years, we won't even, like, remember the person's name who we're worrying about. That's what I think. So you've always got to think that. I just think, look back at some event in your life when you were really worried about something, either social anxiety or worried about your job, and just think, oh God, does it really, it doesn't even matter now, does it?
Exactly.
So, I mean, I remember once getting, I was nearly sacked when I worked in radio when I was starting out my journalism career, and I was a radio news reader, because I called, I was reading the national radio bulletin, and there was this professional footballer called Emil Heskey. And again, because I have no idea about famous people, because I live in a popular culture black hole, I just saw the word Emil, and because I was reading against the clock, I saw Emily. So I said, Emily Heskey. And I remember all the phones lighting up, and I got absolutely bollocked. Am I allowed to say bollocks on this show?
Yeah, go for it.
And I nearly got sacked. I got a verbal warning for getting. And then and at the time, I remember being so mortified, thinking, oh my God, my career's going to end before it's even started. And I look back now and it's funny. So it's things like that. They just, over time, things don't matter.
Exactly. And as PRs, and as a fellow PR myself, we say today's news is tomorrow's fish and chip papers.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Helen Croydon. You are one very influential woman. And if you help one person's life for the better, or to encourage them to take up open swimming outdoors in freezing conditions, or to go cycling for hours on end, you will have improved their life and influenced them with your positivity for their future. Thank you for your time today. The Influential Women's Podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please subscribe for free and keep listening for more podcast guests on our channel on Apple Podcasts, Comcast, Pocket Cast, and Spotify. And we'd love a 5-star review on iTunes. Many thanks.